Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Tuesday. It's January 7th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Welcome to the broadcast. Tumultuous time in our history. We are going to be speaking about what's going on in the Middle East, particularly in the first half hour. Then we're going to be joined by Assembly Member Nader Sayesh, who is the Assembly District Representative to District 90. And after he finishes, we'll continue on with more international news. The most important, of course, is the latest news out of the Middle East. Well, Soleimani's successor vows to force the United States out of the Middle East as oil prices soar. There's a fresh pledge to retaliate. Crude prices break through $70 a barrel, and Gulf shipping warnings are all over the place. So the new leader of Iran's elite Quds force has vowed to expel the United States from the Middle East as Tehran ramped up its rhetoric following the assassination of his predecessor, Qasem Soleimani. Now, crude yesterday broke through $70 a barrel for the first time in more than 3 months after Washington warned of an increased threat to Middle Eastern oil and gas facilities after Soleimani's death in the United States airstrikes on Friday. Well, Brigadier General Ismail Hani told state television that Iran would take its revenge by, quote, uprooting the United States from the region, end quote, and, quote, continuing the work of the martyr Soleimani as robustly as he did. And massive crowds gathered in central Tehran for a third day of public mourning for the slain commander. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei cried as he stood over the military commander's coffin in a rare show of grief by the supreme leader. State media said that several million people attended the ceremony, which is set to conclude when Soleimani is buried in his hometown of Heman today. Now, our commander, quote, our commander has defended us for so many years, said Shirin, a teacher. I did not cry for my father's death as much as I cried for General Soleimani. Brent crude, the global benchmark, rose as high as $70.74 in early trading before easing to about $68.82 a barrel. Crude last traded above $70 in September after drone strikes that the United States blamed on Iran temporarily knocked out half of Saudi Arabia's oil production. Oil prices are likely to rise much further if Iran retaliates, either by attacking Saudi oil facilities as it did in September or attempting to block the Strait of Hormuz, through which 20% of global oil supply is transported, said Michael Pierce, senior U.S. economist at research group Capital Economics. Commercial shipping in the Gulf also faces big risks with a high probability of retaliation against the United States allied interests in the region. The Norwegian Ship Owners Mutual War Risks Association, or DNK, warned in a report that was seen by the Financial Times. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump said that the U.S. would impose sanctions, quote, like they've never seen before, ever, on Iraq if Baghdad followed through on a parliamentary vote to expel U.S. troops from the country in retaliation for last week's U.S. airstrikes, which also killed an Iraqi militia leader. He added that U.S. troops would not leave unless Iraq repaid the cost of an airbase amounting to billions of dollars. Saudi Arabia, Iran's longtime foe and the United States' closest Arab ally, warned that the region was at a, quote, very dangerous moment, end quote. That's what Prince Faisal bin Fahan, the kingdom's foreign minister, had told reporters in Riyadh, quote, we have to be conscious of the risks and dangers, not just to the region, but to wider global security. Well, those are some of the major, major concerns, and that's like the backdrop to what's going on. Well, let's hear what ended up happening as well. There was a stampede in Iran which killed dozens as huge crowds attend the funeral for the slain general. Iranian media say that at least 40 people have been killed and scores more injured in a stampede that erupted during the final stage of funeral processions for late General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in a U.S. strike in Iraq last week. The stampede took place in Haman Soleimani's hometown. As the procession got underway, said the Fars, which is the Persian media outlet and ISNA news agency as well, citing Pir Hossein Koulivand, the head of Iran's emergency medical services. There was no information as to what had set off the stampede. Initial videos posted online showed people lying lifeless on a road and others shouting and trying to help them. Soleimani's funeral was later delayed, but no new timing was given. Unfortunately, as a result of the stampede, some of our compatriots have been injured and some have been killed during the funeral processions, Koulivand had said. In delaying Soleimani's burial, authorities cited concerns about the massive crowd that had gathered, ISNA news agency had reported. So the massive number of mourners in the hometown of the slain commander of the elite Quds force appeared to match the huge turnout seen in the cities of Tehran, Qom, Mashhad, and Ahvaz in recent days. A hugely popular figure in the Islamic Republic, Soleimani was killed outside Baghdad airport on Friday in a drone strike ordered by U.S. President Donald Trump, ratcheting up tensions with arch-enemy Iran, which has vowed, quote, severe revenge, end quote. Quote, the martyr Qasem Soleimani is more powerful now that he is dead, end quote, said the Revolutionary Guard's top general, Major General Hossein Salami. Well, the enemy killed him unjustly, he told the sea of black and black-clad mourners, and schoolgirls joined chants of death to Trump from the crowd, as was reported by an Agence France press correspondent. The assassination of Soleimani set off an escalating war of words between Iran and the United States. In Tehran on Monday, President Hassan Rouhani warned Trump to, quote, never threaten, end quote, Iran, after the U.S. leader issued a U.S. strike list for 52 targets in the Islamic Republic. People converged from afar to Azadi Square, where two flag-draped coffins were on display, with a second one reportedly containing the remains of Soleimani's closest aide, Brigadier General Hossein Pour Jafari. We're here today to pay respects to the great commander of the Holy Defense, end quote, said the mourners who came from the southern city of Shiraz to attend the funeral in Haman. Haj Qasem was not only loved in Haman or Iran, but also the whole world, Hemat Dehan had told Agence France-Presse, quote, the security of the whole world, Muslim, Shiites, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and especially Iran, all owe it to him, said the 56-year-old war veteran. Another mourner said that Soleimani's assassination, quote, boils the blood of the Iranian people, end quote. And quote, he was seen as a great man who was ready to serve his people both then in the war and now. He must certainly be avenged, said Sarah Haksar, an 18-year-old student. And Friday's assassination of the 62-year-old Soleimani heightened international concern about a new war in the volatile Middle East and rattled financial markets. Iraq's parliament has demanded the government expel the 5,200 American troops stationed in the country in response to the drone attack, which also killed top Iraqi military figure Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. And Baghdad requested in a letter to the United Nations, seen by Agence France-Presse, that the Security Council condemn the United States drone strike so that, quote, the law of the jungle, end quote, was not allowed to prevail. The operation represented, quote, a dangerous escalation that could lead to a devastating war in Iraq, the region, and the world, wrote the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations, Mohammed Hussein Bahar al-Ulum. Now, world financial markets have been on edge over the crisis. Quote, the new year has started with a bang in so far as volatility is concerned, said Fawad Razakzada in foreignexchange.com, forexexchange.com. Forex.com. So, quote, this is mainly due to the escalation of tensions between the United States and Iran after Trump ordered the assassination of Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani. On Sunday night, the United States mistakenly notified the Iraqi government of an imminent troop pullout in a letter that sparked confusion in Washington. Quote, We respect your sovereign decision to order our departure, said the letter, whose authenticity was confirmed to Agence France-Presse by both Iraqi and U.S. defense officials. In the letter, U.S. Brigadier General William Seely said that the U.S.-led coalition would, quote, be repositioning forces, end quote. But Pentagon Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley said the letter was a mere, quote, draft, end quote, and, quote, should not have been sent, end quote. It was a mistake, an honest mistake, a draft unsigned letter because we are moving forces around, Milley told reporters in Washington. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said the letter was, quote, inconsistent, end quote, with Washington's position and denied there had been a decision to leave Iraq. Well, NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg warned on Monday that Iran must avoid, quote, further violence and provocations, end quote, after the alliance held emergency talks on the crisis. The European Union, whose foreign ministers will hold emergency talks on the crisis on Friday, said it was in both Iran and Iraq's interest to, quote, take the path of sobriety and not the path of escalation, end quote. Saudi Arabia, an oil-rich U.S. ally seen as vulnerable to Iranian countered strikes, also appealed for calm for a very dangerous, quote-unquote, escalation. Now, Soleimani is expected to be buried at the Martyrs Cemetery in Hammam between 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon local time. Oh, my gosh. So we'll see exactly where that goes, because who knows. Okay, so we told you about the letter that was mistakenly dispersed. Then we have some unbelievable change of circumstances, unheard of. Putin is meeting Assad in a surprise Syria visit. And it seems that Russian President, Vladimir Putin met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad on Tuesday during a surprise visit to Damascus. His first since the start of the nearly 9-year-old war, the presidency said. Russian President Vladimir Putin arrived in Damascus for a visit during which he met President Assad at the headquarters of the Russian forces, it said in a statement. The two leaders listened to a military presentation by the commander of Russian forces in Syria, said the presidency, which posted a picture of the two leaders shaking hands. Putin extended his greetings to Russian forces for the Orthodox Christmas. And the Russian leader had visited Syria in December of 2017, but had not been to the capital, only stopping at the Russian base of Hmeymim on the Mediterranean coast. So that is the circumstance over there. Now, and then Iraqi armed factions are calling for a meeting to begin an anti-U.S. fight. It seems that Iraqi armed forces called today for an urgent meeting to face, quote, the war against the resistance, end quote, after a U.S. strike on Baghdad last week killed top Iranian and Iraqi commanders. Quote, we will regroup the forces of the resistance in a single entity to respond to Washington, end quote, said Nasser al-Shamari, the deputy head of the Harakat al-Nujaba group. Nujaba, backed by Iran and fiercely opposed to the United States, is one of the most hardline factions of Iraq's Hashed al-Sha'abi military network, which has been incorporated into the state. The Hashed's deputy chief, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was killed in the American precision strike on Friday that also killed Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani. Now, Soleimani was known as the godfather, quote-unquote, of Iran's allies abroad, who broadly identify as the, quote, resistance axis, end quote. The American aggression against the Hashed al-Sha'abi was or has marked the beginning of the war against the resistance, end quote, Shamari said in a statement. The statement did not identify the factions invited, but it was expected the Hashed's pro-Iran factions and forces loyal to cleric Muqtada Sadr would attend. Sadr has reactivated his notorious Mahdi army, the militia that fought U.S. troops after their 2003 invasion, calling for the formation of, quote, international resistance regiments, end quote. Hayes al-Khazali, a military leader and bitter rival of Sadr's, echoed his call and threatened the United States that his forces would, quote, turn the skies above you into hell, end quote. In his statement, Shamari said that the resistance, quote, unquote, would respond across the region and said his group was already in touch with Iran-backed Lebanese movement Hezbollah. Quote, we will wage a war against the American presence in all parts of the region that we can reach, he said, describing the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad as a, quote, den of spies, end quote. Thousands of Marines are present in possible targets, he said. Iran has already vowed vengeance, quote, unquote, for Soleimani, who was mourned by unprecedented crowds across the country on Monday. Today, thousands of Iraqis also accompanied a funeral procession that brought Muhandis's remains to his native Basra. It's in the southern part of the nation, an oil-rich southern city, chanting death to America, quote, unquote. The Hashed said his remains had been briefly taken to Iran for DNA testing to separate them from those of Soleimani, as the U.S. drone strike had dismembered their bodies. Like other Shiite Muslims, Muhandis would ultimately be buried in the Iraqi shrine city of Najaf, in what is known as the largest cemetery in the world. Following his death, Iraqi parliamentarians voted in favor of ousting foreign forces. The Pentagon admitted on Monday that a top U.S. general had mistakenly informed the Iraqi government that his troops were preparing to withdraw, which was an error, evidently so stated after the fact by the United States. So, you know, really major, major crisis, no matter how we cut it. Just one second. All right, bear with me a moment because I just want to go back to see what else is happening on the world stage. There's so much that's going on. Let me just quickly see if there are any other issues that are coming out of the Middle East. At the moment, I guess they're all overwhelmed. This is interesting because this comes from France for no other reason, but just that there's a perspective. There is a place for diplomacy, so says France's Le Drian, in the wake of Soleimani's killing. France's foreign ministry said on Monday that Tehran must not retaliate over the killing of top general Qasem Soleimani in a U.S. airstrike amid an escalating war of words between Iranian officials and President Donald Trump. Quote, it is essential that Iran renounce any reprisals or retaliations, Jean-Yves Le Drian told BFM television, adding, quote, that there is still a place for democracy, for diplomacy, fortunately, he said. In all the talks I've held with other officials, no one wants a war, he added, while deploring, quote, bad choices on all sides, end quote, for the, quote, dangerous escalation, end quote, of tension between Tehran and Washington. As Rian said, any counterstrikes against the United States would jeopardize the viability of the coalition fighting the Islamic State group threat in Iraq and Syria, which he said must remain the region's priority. He also urged Tehran to refrain from further steps to undo the 2015 accord, curtailed its nuclear activities ahead of an emergency meeting by European Union foreign ministers on the Iran crisis this week. Paris will decide, quote, in the coming days, end quote, whether it will renew sanctions against Iran for walking away from the deal, Le Drian had said, after months of trying to uphold the deal despite, quote, Trump's decision to abandon it. So, very, very compelling perspective. We'll have to see if that carries any weight. One second. Let me find all the other notes. Okay, Ben, there's some interesting issues. In menacing Iran's cultural sites, evidently Trump is threatening to commit, quote, a war crime, end quote. It seems that the Trump administration has yet to offer any evidence backing its claim that last week's killing of a senior Iranian official was legal under international law, Now the United States president has also threatened to target Iran's cultural sites, an action experts say would amount to committing a war crime. Well, President Donald Trump insisted on Sunday that Iranian cultural sites were fair game for the United States military, dismissing concerns that targeting the country's heritage would constitute a war crime under international law. Trump's comments came amid escalating tensions in the Middle East following Friday's strike on General Qassem Soleimani, the head of Iran's elite Quds force, who was widely regarded as the second most powerful figure in the Iranian regime, and Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike on an airport in Baghdad. Now, Iran has vowed to avenge Soleimani's death, and Iraq's parliament responded by voting on Sunday to oust U.S. troops based in the country, in turn prompting Trump to threaten Baghdad with sanctions like they've never seen before, quote unquote. So U.S. president first raised the prospect of targeting Iranian cultural sites in a tweet on Saturday evening, warning that if Iran attacks any American assets to avenge Soleimani's killing, the U.S. has 52 targets across the Islamic Republic that, quote, will be hit very hard and very hard, end quote. Some are, quote, important to Iran and Iranian culture, Trump had added. So speaking with reporters on Sunday as he returned to Washington from his holiday stay in Florida, the United States president doubled down on his insistence that cultural sites were fair game. Quote, they're allowed to kill our people. They're allowed to torture and maim our people. They're allowed to use roadside bombs and blow up our people, and we're not allowed to touch their cultural sites. It doesn't work that way, Trump said, according to a Pool report. His comments prompted fury in Iran and consternation among critics in the United States and around the world. Through millennia of history, barbarians have come and ravaged our cities, razed our monuments, and burnt our libraries, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted on Sunday. Where are they now? We're still here and still standing. Well, after committing grave breaches, quote unquote, in killing Soleimani, Trump is now threatening a war crime in targeting cultural sites, Zarif had added. Iran's wealth of historic monuments preserved the legacy of a civilization that is a source of great pride among Iranians, from hardliners in Tehran to the diaspora of Iranians in the West. I'm not sure when he, meaning Trump, says cultural sites. Does he, for example, mean our Persepolis? Asked Meldad Hadir, a cultural and political analyst in Tehran, referring in an interview with the Associated Press to the ancient ruins invaded by the Greeks in 330 BC. Does he want to be seen as the new Alexander the Great by Iranians? I'm really sorry that we are living in a world where the president of the biggest so-called superpower still doesn't know that attacking cultural sites is a war crime, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Abbas Mousavi told journalists in Tehran on Sunday, and telecommunications minister Mohammad Javad Azari Yaromi compared Trump's threats to the Islamic State group Adolf Hitler and Genghis Khan, calling the United States president a, quote, terrorist in a suit, end quote. Well, targeting cultural sites is a war crime under the 1954 Hague Convention. The United Nations Security Council also unanimously passed a resolution in 2017 condemning the destruction of heritage sites such as that carried out by the Islamic State group in Iraq and in Syria, to no avail because it didn't mean squat. Anyway, whatever they said. Anyway, they passed legislation that amounted to Zippo. At the same time, the United Nations reiterated that actions targeting cultural locations constitutes a war crime. Well, the deliberate destruction of our common cultural heritage constitutes a war crime and represents an attack on humanity as a whole, said the spokesman for then United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon back in 2015. U.S. experts have also stressed the illegal nature of the action threatened by the U.S. president. Una Hathaway, an international law professor at Yale and a former national security law official in the Department of Defense's legal office, told the Associated Press that Trump's threats amounted to, quote, a pretty clear promise of commission of a war crime. Well, Hathaway pointed to legal problems with both of Trump's threats on Saturday, the threat to hit 52 targets to Iran for symbolic reasons, and the threat to strike Iranian cultural sites, arguing that would constitute war crimes. The first threat would be a war crime because Trump justified it on symbolic grounds of retribution for Iran's hostage-taking of 52 U.S. citizens 40 years ago. Hathaway explained the second threat would amount to a war crime under the 1954 Hague Convention on the Protection of Cultural Sites, she added. Hathaway also said that Soleimani killing was itself most likely illegal because the administration had not proven the threat he posed was so, quote, imminent, and, quote, it required urgent action without consulting Congress, quote. In interviews with six different U.S. television networks over the weekend, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the administration would have been, quote, culpably negligent, end quote, in its duty to protect the United States if it had not killed Soleimani. However, he did not provide evidence for his previous claims that Soleimani was plotting imminent attacks on Americans, using different language to qualify the magnitude of the threat instead of arguing that an attack instigated by Soleimani had been imminent. Pompeo claimed it was, quote, inevitable, end quote. In his interviews, Washington's top diplomat tiptoed around questions about Trump's threat to kill culture or to hit cultural sites, insisting that any U.S. military strikes inside Iran would be legal. We'll behave inside the system, Pompeo said. We always have and we always will. That's a quote. And Pompeo refused to give any details on the 52 potential targets that Trump had said had been drawn up to represent each and every hostage held in the standoff at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran that began in 1979. But one former official expressed skepticism that military planners would agree to target cultural sites. For what it's worth, I find it hard to believe the Pentagon would provide Trump targeting options that include Iranian cultural sites, Colin Kahl, who was national security advisor to a former Vice President Joe Biden, wrote on Twitter. Trump may not care about the laws of war, but the Department of Defense, planners, and lawyers do, and targeting cultural sites is war crime, Kyle had said. Others pointed to a flagrant contradiction between Trump's threats and the U.S. stance on heritage protection. Nicholas Burns, who served as U.S. ambassador to NATO during former President George W. Bush, said that the Trump administration would be guilty of hypocrisy given it was part of international efforts to deter the Islamic State group from destroying countless pre-Islamic artifacts, including the Syrian UNESCO-listed city of Palmyra. Donald Trump's threat to destroy Iranian cultural sites would be a war crime under UN Security Council Resolution 2347, supported by the Trump administration itself in 2017 to warn ISIS and Al-Qaeda of similar actions, said Trump Burns, who is now a professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. His threat is immoral and un-American, added the former ambassador on Twitter. The United States has taken a leadership role in the protection of antiquities from destruction and illicit trade, particularly in the Middle East, said Deborah Lehr, LEHR, the chairwoman and founder of the Washington-based Antiquities Coalition, in an interview with the New York Times. Quote, it would be a shame to see that global good will disappear by the intentional targeting and the destruction of cultural sites, she added. Quote, Iran is home to two dozen UNESCO World Heritage Sites, including the ruins of Persepolis, the 17th century Grand Mosque of Isfahan, located in a teeming bazaar, and the Golestan Palace in the heart of Tehran. Its cultural sites reflect the expanse of Iran's history and its contribution to the Golden Age of Islam. More recently, though, some of the most iconic cultural sites have come to embody the nation's defiance in its standoff with the United States. Hundreds of thousands gather at the iconic Azadi Tower in Tehran each year to mark the anniversary of the 1979 revolution and chant anti-American slogans. Whew, my God, stuff that's going on around the world. Well, I need to return to our screen. We're soon going to be joined by, none other than Nader Sayers, bear with me a moment here. And we're going to speak to Nader Sayers. He's the New York State Assemblyman representing Assembly District 90, and we're going to speak to him to his most recently successful effort to gain funding for the Yonkers Public School District. We'll see what sort of heavy lifting that takes, and so on and so forth. Oh, there he is. Perfect timing. I don't know how he does this. Good morning, Assembly Member Nader Sayers. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Yehazi Arias. Always a pleasure. Good morning to you, and especially this seventh day of January. Imagine, Yehazi, 2020. I remember.
It really is amazing.
I remember 20 years ago when the turn of the century, huh? And all the fear.
Absolutely.
And now it's 20 years later.
It really is. I don't know if we've evolved in any way, shape, or form. It looks like we've more devolved on an international scale, so we'll have to see where that goes. But let's celebrate. First of all, are you celebrating the Eastern Christmas today? Or was it yesterday?
Actually, some community members are, you know, but generally the consensus, you know, among Christians around the world is celebrate Christmas on December 25th, which we do, and Easter on the Orthodox calendar, you know. So that's but some people still celebrate the different calendars, and I've always been an advocate for try to unify the calendar, you know, get the heads of the churches together, and I think for Christianity in general, they should celebrate Christmas, together and celebrate Easter together. But, you know, everybody
has
their
process.
Everybody has their process.
Yeah, everyone has their own process. But the first church of Christianity, I guess, began in the Middle East, didn't it? So it used to be celebrated. Christmas was celebrated on the 6th or the 7th of January. So I don't know why Rome had decided to come up with a different date, but I guess that's politics too, you know. So who knows? Everything is politics, isn't it?
It is. How are you today, Hezzy? Everything is fine. You're doing
thank
well.
God. Thank goodness. I've got no complaints. So I'm really pleased. Well, I'm delighted that you've been able to make the time because it gives us an opportunity to celebrate some of your accomplishments. This is the first year you've been an assembly member in the New York State Assembly, and you've already proven yourself successful, which is like almost unheard of, I think. But we're not talking peanuts or change here. You were able to gain funding for the Yonkers Public School District. How did that come about?
Well, usually... you know, we lobby state delegation and individual members lobby for the greater share of funding. And in addition to the regular funding source, foundation aid and so forth, you know, we get commitments of what they call SAM funding, which is more utilized state funding for capital projects. And I lobbied and was designated $1 million of funding, of which $750,000 I felt would be worthy to designate for two projects in Yonkers, involved in the Yonkers Public Schools. And the $750,000, one project would be the Lincoln High School Auditorium. I don't know if you've been at the facility, but that's really the largest arena or forum Yonkers has. So not only does Lincoln High School utilize the Lincoln High Auditorium, but the entire public school district and the entire city of Yonkers, whenever there's major concerts or events of any sort, they've had recently a major My Brother's Keeper event, for example, that was held there. So the building and the facility itself, really, it's no secret, Yonkers schools are on the average 80 years old, and they're depleted, and very often the stage and the lighting and the sound system and even the seating, even the bleachers at the Yonkers Middle High School arena, which is the other side, you know, and the girls and boys locker and the gym floors. I mean, when that starts to deplete and starts to deteriorate, it really causes a safety concern, and you don't enjoy these facilities as much. So $750,000 was really part of my commitment. When I was elected, I made a pledge to represent the best interest of, the Yonkers students and the educational mm-hmm. system. And with all its faults, that $750,000 coupled with district funding and I'm sure city funding, they would put together a package that would bring about really major results. But the seed money was that $750,000. So I'm proud of it. We had a nice press conference, and I think it's a shot in the arm, but it doesn't take away from the major battle that we're still fighting to make sure we renovate Yonkers schools. I have a special piece of legislation that I've sponsored already that is in the Education Committee that would allow the state to up the amount of funding Yonkers gets to renovate and build new schools. They had us at 50 cents a dollar when they give Buffalo and Rochester and these other communities 98 cents on a dollar. And they mm-hmm. build and they renovate and they're losing enrollment. And Yonkers is one of the few urban settings in the state that is increasing enrollment. So here we are, we're losing space, our buildings are old, we have serious problems that impacts the learning atmosphere. Kids have to learn in buildings where there's roof leaks and there's, God forbid, asbestos and lead in the piping and other mm-hmm. dangerous situations. And here we are, the state shortchanges us. These type of things, you almost have to go up to Albany, Hezzy, and you got to have short-term battles and long-term battles. And the short-term is bringing in the 750,000 grants, and the long-term is changing the way the state funds. So we're battling on multiple fronts, Hezzy.
Well, when we talk about battling for funding, I didn't expect it. It seemed out of left field. It seems that the state legislature is going to be tackling a $6.1 billion deficit for this coming year, for 2020.
Correct.
That's not a very
Correct.
Propitious way to start off the new decade. It's not a positive outcome. Just being so great, I guess that would undermine the capacity of a change in the formula with respect to Yonkers and other communities that are similarly challenged for it to change. I remember hearing a few months ago the mayor was hoping to build a new school no matter what, but I thought we were getting a 70% cut rather than 50% on a building of a school, and then supposedly the state has to okay it so that they would give their part. But we can't even afford a $100 million building. We can't even afford to pay off the $30 million because that amounts to like a 10% increase in our tax. So how do
well,
we get
right.
around these issues?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, we, from the last couple of years, even my days when I was president of the Board of Education, the plans
right.
were to build three new schools. And when the state approved our plans to build three new schools, they turned around and said, fine, we're going to give you 70% when we're given, again, like I said before, Buffalo and Syracuse 90. And other urbans, mm-hmm. 98%. But
right.
when you build three schools and you're talking about $3 billion, and then you look at that 30% cost that Yonkers would have to take under its belt and its taxpayers,
yeah.
you're talking about $60 million that we couldn't afford. So it put the brakes on, and we started to lobby the state to increase that 70%. Right now, as you said earlier, the plan is to build one school, and that we're looking at, mm-hmm. The Grand Park. If you're familiar with Grand Park north of Ashburton, that site, along with the former Mulford Garden site, is really where they're planning to build the school, no matter what the state issue is. that involves local funding, private developers. It's a plan that's in the works now that would have a school somewhere in the Midwestern part of the city that may alleviate some of the overcrowded and facility problems we have. But it's sad because these projects take a couple of years, you know, and if that's only one third of our solution to our really citywide needs of three buildings, then you know, just I worry about the projections that if this slow moving type of process, you know, took us this many years just to get one building on the plans potentially. You know, when are we going to address our real needs with the second and third building and even extensive renovations to the remaining buildings in the district? It's a problem. And I see the population of Yonkers really continuously increasing. If you look at the city and you look at our downtown and the development that's going on the waterfront, potentially this city, I think within a few years, we'd surpass the 220,000 mark and maybe even more. And we'll definitely, I think, with the upcoming census, potentially be the third largest city in the state. We're now number four, but from what I gather with the trends of people moving in and out of communities, we will bypass Rochester shortly. And whoever the future think tanks and the people that are thinking ahead and planning on the local and state level really got to recognize that, you know, when you get 10, 20,000 more residents in your community, it's going to impact fire and health and education and other vital services. And whether
that's the question then. What is it about the argument that we make that requests equanimity and a sense of fairness when we look at the entire budget, and that Yonkers has never been, well, Yonkers seems to have been shortchanged. So what's the rationale for that? Why is the rest of the state not interested in permitting Yonkers to get its fair share? I know they're not giving a fair share to places out in Long Island when it comes to education, or to places like Ossining or Portchester and other places.
Yeah.
But it seems that Yonkers has been saddled with this issue for maybe what, two or three decades. When is this going to stop?
You know, Hezzy, we've been fighting this issue from my days as a school principal and going on buses with PTA and students and city and board people. And the problem is, in my opinion, the state funding formula that decides how much they send per kid to each community, in my opinion, is outdated. It's wrong. It's inequitable. It's largely based on the wealth of the county you live in. And the bottom line is, you know, we in Yonkers and communities across the state that have similar problems, we happen to be in a county, Westchester County, that we know is very wealthy. But the fact is, nearly 80% of our student population is on free and reduced lunch. So I've already put legislation this session in Albany to tackle this problem and once and for all to demand that the state changes the way we fund education. It's not fair. It's not equitable. It mistreats high-need students, whether special education students or English language learners. And this bill would put a new dynamic of five components that have to be placed in this new funding formula that will, again, determine, you know, how much funding each community. And this bill is not a Yonkers bill. It's a statewide bill. As you said, Hezzy, this will impact communities across the state, and God knows there's many communities that happen to be part of counties and communities that are on paper considered wealthy, but they have 50% or more English language learners. They have 50% or more, for example, kids that are on free and reduced lunch. And to me, these are these are criteria that really determine what the financial or fiscal, you know, stand-in of students and their parents in the community in their public schools. You know, and it's not not a small change. It's $5,000 a year less per kid that we're getting. So this is why when they tell us on the state level, you guys from Yonkers are up here every year begging us, because we're always short $50+ million. We're getting less than the other communities. That's why we're up here begging. Fix the funding process.
Well, you know, but I don't. I understand we've been begging, but I really wonder. We supposedly have leadership. We have a lot of people in very, very big places in positions, and nothing seems to have changed. So, is this all talk? I mean, is there any basis for why Yonkers doesn't get its fair share? Hey, you know, Ossining doesn't get its fair share. Porchester doesn't get its fair share, and that's in Westchester County. They're paying high taxes. Are they spending the same amount of money that we're spending? For example, in Yonkers, it costs $27,000 a kid to educate them. And last I read, I mean, what's her name? The communication director, I forgot, she's now in Florida anyway, a total waste of time. She was gloating over the fact that 35% of our student population are proficient in math and in English, and yet 65% are not. So, you know, it's, you know,
a major problem.
Is the message, she's the problem, and so is the Board of Education. I'm getting sick and tired of hearing double talk. Which way is it? Are we proficient or are we not proficient? Are we spending the right amount of money or we're wasting the right amount of money? Who is in charge? It seems like nobody's in charge, and there's a lot of stuff that's going on that's wrong. I don't get it. I don't know. I can't for the life of me. I'm getting older and older. I swear to you, I do not fathom the rationale for our not getting a fair share. And I know that we can't even afford to build a new building. I don't need a school building. And you know what's really interesting? Even if we could, you know what's so fascinating when we hear pronouncements? Oh, we're going to build the school no matter what, even if the state doesn't allow us to. No problem. Really? What the hell are you building? What, are you going to put up another stupid building with no concept of what's inside? Is it technologically advanced? Is it a waste of time? Is it going to be out of date the moment we even actually think about it? I don't understand where we're going wrong. I don't get it.
Well,
you know,
I
have to applaud you because you went up there with everybody else telling us the way it really was, and you're able to deliver. And you know what? At the end of the day, but it's better than anybody else.
Well, we try. You know, we try to fill as many holes, but it shouldn't be that way. I agree with you. And that's why it's a big problem. It's a big concern. And,
well, you know, the other problem, too, is when you bring in people up to Albany and year after year after year, you keep asking, not you personally, but the administrations, whoever they may be, and there were so many, they keep asking for a fair share. And parents go up there on buses or whichever way they go. And then nothing happens. And it goes on for what, 20 or 30 years? No wonder nobody shows up. I mean, it's pathetic. What's wrong with our message?
Even with the initial years ago with lottery funds, you know, the initial projections were that some 80% of the money collected from lottery was supposed to go to education. And 20%, you know, which is proper, you know, to cover administration and the delivery of funds and so forth. Then, you know, when I was in session this past session, you know, looking at data, and I find out that when you get down to the nuts and bolts, only 34% of lotto funding actually goes to education. That's ridiculous. Mm. I mean, you know, something is wrong if lotto was to have prevented any shortfalls in education, something went wrong. Where did the money go? You know, when you look at the amount of money generated from lotto, it should cover all the educational and the back due funding aid formulas,
right.
School districts, even Yonkers. If you were to give these communities what the state owes them, that would help resolve a lot of their problems and fill the void. You know, and now we're talking about sport betting. We're looking at gambling. We're looking at legalizing
marijuana.
You know, and what people are saying is, oh, these legislation pieces would be good for New York because, look, all surrounding states and neighbors have these legislative reforms, and they're getting additional funding and taxes and so forth, and we're going to designate those funds to fill the void for Medicaid losses and health care and education.
Mm-hmm.
But then I look at the lotto situation, and my concern is, you know, we may end up voting to legalize marijuana and sport betting, thinking, many of us, that, oh, this will resolve the educational, health care, and Medicaid needs and take care of problems like the potential $6 billion deficit. But then you wonder, with what happened, the experience with lottery, you know, is this going to be the case or not? You know, that's why part of the legislation has to make sure there's designated quotas so that nobody plays games with it, that, you know, clearly X percent of funding from taxation involved in sport betting goes to public education or whatever the percentages are. That's
right.
The only way you can really resolve it. But to pass these legislative pieces without being very specific is a concern for me. You know, so I've made that clear to some of my fellow legislators that, hey, I'll explore and look at these new legislative proposals before us. And, you know, as you know, tomorrow's session starts. Tomorrow we'll be headed to Albany. Some legislators are up there already. I like to stay in Yonkers as long as I could. But I haven't missed one session last year. Not one session because it's important. I want to be involved with the process A to Z. I want to make sure that, you know, I get on as many committees as possible. And I want to make sure that, you know, my stay up there is fruitful, that, you know, I'm not there to waste my time or anybody else's time. Anybody that has known me from my days as an educator, as an attorney, you know, I like to see action. You know, I understand that be give and take, but I want to see action right away.
Well, doesn't the fact that you have a legal background and also a background in education, those two disciplines really tie in together with respect to the final outcome, which is legislation, and you're able to not only know the inside stuff that goes on in education, but you're able to bring the legal aspect of it so that you can protect whatever legislation is passed through a legal format where there's a bite, God forbid, that something gets taken away. So either the legislation is valid or it isn't valid, and there's got to be some repercussions when the state or anybody else tries to take away from it. Is that one of the that's what I've always thought was deficient in the people we elect to office. They just don't have a clue. No discipline. Just because you're good looking and which you are too, but I mean the bottom line is that's not sufficient.
Thank
you know.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I appreciate that.
Well, one of the other things is like, how do you get, like, for example, we have a law in New York State now that demands that every child be inoculated. We have kids in the Yonkers Public School who are not inoculated. We're not talking about 5 or 10. We're talking over 1,000. That's the law. How is it that we can skirt the law? And is that part of our problem, too? People don't believe that whatever we claim we're going to do, we're doing. It's illegal.
See, when the state passed vaccination laws, you know, it really had – it was a reaction to a potential, or many people felt, an ongoing epidemic that was up in Rockland and also in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And many people, including myself, you know, were concerned early on about preserving individual liberties and religious rights and constitutional, you know, rental rights. But then, you know, as a society, we're always concerned about, you know, potential epidemics that really allow you to say, well, you know, in this case, yes, although I'm a supporter of parental and constitutional rights, you know, the good of the community at large is crucial. And my vote and track record such where I you know, I myself, I'm someone who's been vaccinated. I have five children that are vaccinated.
Yeah.
So I support vaccination. But at the same time, you know, there's a fine line with whether or not individuals that have a track record where they're deserving of a medical exemption, you know, the state shouldn't give them a hard time. They should give them a medical exemption. If a child has a history that causes a serious reaction to vaccination, then in most cases, I believe healthcare professionals and doctors shouldn't restrict children from having medical exemptions.
But that's not defined. That's not defined. You know, then, you know, I'm sorry, it just never cuts it. You know, if you have 1,000 to 1,500 kids, you mean to tell me all should have an exemption? I don't think so.
No.
You know, it doesn't work. You know, you might find what, 10 people?
I agree. They should all have, you know, medical documentation. You know, they should really educate the medical profession, the healthcare, as to what are legitimate grounds. It has to be equitable. It has to be fair.
Okay.
It has to be clearly defined. And I think,
I don't disagree with you. But then the question is, when there was an outbreak of measles in Rockland County, how much time do you have to get all this stuff done? What, do you have a week to get it done while more people are getting infected? You know, I went to the doctor myself because I was worried, you know, are my inoculations good? I was born in a country where they didn't have inoculations. So I got all these diseases, you know, it was standard. Everybody did it. You know, the kids got it.
Yeah.
You got whooping cough. You got rubella. You got measles. You got German measles. Everything you could imagine. The point
but
is,
you
so,
know,
you're
so right. I mean, when I listen to stories back, you know, my family originated from Jordan and, you know, in small villages many years ago. And then you talk to some of
that.
The old timers. Yeah, you didn't have that. And then you find out that the average family had to have between 8 to 10 kids because, you know, half of them died. And well, how
That's
did this
right.
Well, you know, and then you find out it was measles, it was other, you know, it was other conditions,
right.
and people don't realize that so many young people generations ago, because of, you know, measles and a lot of other outbreaks. So, you know, those that are advocating strongly that, you know, even though people may strongly fight against, you know, these vaccinations, that if they're good for society, good for the community, and it protects everyone at large, then it should be mandated. But you know, you have such a solid base of individuals that truly believe that, you know, I shouldn't be forced to vaccinate my child. And then the opposition will tell you, well, why should you let that child go into my school or go into my drugstore or go into my Kmart and then potentially harm my pregnant wife's upcoming child or whomever.
Right.
So, you know, you try to listen to every side. You try to listen to every argument.
Yeah, but that's respectful, of course. But, you know, when I went to the doctor to check and he said, well, did you get inoculated for this, that, or the other? And I said, no, because I remember when I was a young child, my mother told me that I got all of those. So he said, okay, we could check it out. We see if the antibodies are still functioning. I was shocked. They still are. You know, it's been like, 70 years since I had all these things, or 65 years since I had them. But they're still functioning. And then I remember when I was growing up, all of a sudden there was another scare. This time it was mumps. And
yeah.
It turns out that if you're a male, that beyond puberty, and you catch mumps because you don't have the inoculation against it, or you never had it when you were younger, before puberty, you would be sterile.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's an impact for a lot of the stuff. I didn't have to worry. My mother said, don't worry about it. You're not affected by that because you got it at a very young age. But the point is, I asked her when I was an adult, and she said, no, there's nothing to worry about because of that. But that's the whole point, isn't it? You can't assume that because you want your rights, but you live in a society, don't you? How
yeah,
can you be walking
do.
Around your disease?
And now, you know, now
what
you
do
have
we do with when
now you, now you have some fellow legislators that are looking to allow minors, you know, 12 and 13-year-olds with other vaccinations to get the vaccinations without parental approval. These are bills that this session would go before the legislators, and a lot of people are concerned with allowing minors to get vaccinations without parental support or approval. That's going to be another hot issue. And honestly, you know, I got to look at that closer. I have concerns about that. To what extent do we start chipping away at taking away parental involvement or rights in the health and management of their children? So these are all
issues.
It's a big issue. We're going to deal with it this session. As I said, tomorrow the governor has his state of the state. You know, we'll officially start session. It's the first day of session. And I'm looking forward. We'll be up there in Albany on the average 3 days a week. You know, the district offices are always open. We had the pleasure of sending out recently a major fall-winter newsletter with some of the issues that we're confronted with and what legislation or bills are before the assembly that we sponsored. And again, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to be on the air and to talk about what goes on or should go on in Albany that impacts Yonkers in the state. And again, I encourage the listening audience, as it to really, you know, give us input. You know, the office is at 35 East Grassy Sprain Road.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is involved to come in, speak to the staff. I'd love to speak with as many individuals as possible, make appointments, and give us your input on especially the new legislation before us, sport betting and recreational marijuana and issues like that and vaccinations. This way we can hopefully get as much input as possible and make the right decisions.
Want to ask you about one last thing before you go. There was legislation which got rid of bail. So that you could come in and there was, and then you would be released the next day or the same day, whatever. In the old days, they had bail, and I guess the richest people in the world, they had no problem putting up the $200,000 bond. There was no issue for them. However, there are people who don't have even $25 in their pocket and wouldn't be permitted to depart. And be free in their own recognizance until whenever the case is supposed to have come before him. So, but now people are being released, and they're committing the same crime that they were initially arrested for. How come we didn't recognize these are the issues? Are we starting to lose sight of law? Are we governing because of demographic changes? And what are those demographic changes that cause us to malign our own systems? I'm just so confused by this. I'm blown away.
Hazy, bring up a good point. I mean, bail reform, criminal justice reform. The last session, that was a major piece of legislation that the Assembly and Senate and the governor pushed for. And largely, in a nutshell, the legislative thinking or ideology was that, and I agree with that, it wasn't fair when you dealt with bail that money was the only factor. You know, the whole system of criminal justice and the whole imprisonment system, you know, to be placed in prison was largely based on the crime you committed.
Right, but people shouldn't have been, you know, thrown into Rikers Island for a thousand days because they didn't have the money.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the principles that we voted on, I think, are just and fair, and that is to say, hey, you know, shouldn't be based on money. And if you don't have money and you're being thrown in jail for a minor crime, something that, you know, there's a difference with felony crimes and misdemeanors. You know, felony is serious crimes in general. And I think each and every one of us agrees that if a criminal commits a felony type of crime and it really hurts or impacts individuals or society, you know, then imprisonment is a deterrent. You know, historically, it was necessary to teach someone that, hey, what you did was wrong and you got to be punished for it. But then, you know, if there's a minor crime committed by two individuals and one goes home because he has money and one has to go to jail because he doesn't have money, that's not fair.
Right. That's
but
wrong.
Having said that,
absolutely wrong.
I think the law enforcement community and others have brought up some interesting data and opinions, whereas, you know, thank you for putting forth this new criminal justice reform and this new bail reform, but, you know, there's certain things that we need to revisit, and that includes the whole discovery process.
Well, aren't there things that are missing here? Because if you incarcerate somebody for something innocuous because they don't have the $25 or $100 to get bail, which is now thrown out the window anyway, the point is they probably don't have a job. And so even if you keep them in prison for whatever infraction they did, are we teaching them anything to make them viable when they get out? You know, it's always like,
you're right.
It's part like, of, I don't know, of, I don't know what we're doing. We have no, it, we repeat the same thing because the catalyst is always there. We need to give them jobs.
That's why the jail system has you got to provide, and some institutions do so. And some, for example, need to really catch up and provide in rehabilitation, education. You know, there's a lot of attempts to make sure that the prison system allows prisoners not to be more than 500 miles away from home or even closer. I mean, the individuals that are placed in criminals in jail, you know, sometimes are insensitive to if a criminal had a history of health concerns, then you got to make sure you place that prisoner in a facility that's near a hospital. If they have a heart condition, if they have diabetes, you got to make sure they at least can stay healthy while in jail. They do their time.
Right.
You got to make sure that, you know, they're given opportunity to rehabilitate, with counseling, with support services, with job training. You know, from my understanding, and I've reached out to many prisoners who were ex-prisoners and even felons, ex-felons, and some of them give you decent stories about the facilities they're at, where they were given those opportunities. And some are terrible experiences where, you know, it was very traumatic, and sometimes did not do justice to that individual.
No.
And sometimes, you know, these individuals, when they leave jail and they haven't been given these services, you know, end up going back to jail because they really weren't taught, you know, what they did was wrong and how to correct it and how to think different. You know, so I agree with you. I think whatever is going on that is positive needs to sometimes, unfortunately, go through legislation where it's mandated, where these facilities need to do A, B, C, D, and not just, you know, house prisoners where you keep them away from home, they lose the value system of, especially if they have children and spouses and so forth, and parents. You know, why make it so detrimental where the frustration level and the harm is worse than trying to rehabilitate? And I think these are crucial points. But I agree that the criminal justice reforms that were passed, I think in some areas should be looked at again and should be tweeted a little bit where you don't take away the basic reason for bail reform, which I believe is a good one, you know, because you want to keep money out of the process. But at the same time, you want to make sure that law enforcement can do their job. You want to make sure that violent criminals are not put back on the streets, even with these latest incidents of hate crimes. That is terrible.
Yeah.
You know, and people are going out and burning menorahs and burning crosses and going on and shooting, you know, houses of worship and so forth. That is such an ill in society. It's so terrible. And these individuals, in some cases, under the present laws and systems, you know, can be committing what they call misdemeanors or lower crimes, you know, in the past that don't allow these individuals to be placed in jail. And under the new bail reform system, they may be put out on the streets again. So I know some of
Isn't that also a problem with mental illness? Like, there has to be some sort of degree of mental issues, isn't there? I mean, even if you're found on the streets wandering and with homeless, that's gotta really do a number on your mind.
It is.
Well, that's your well-being.
Well, see, a lot of this goes to the core, Hezzy. You know, we spoke before about just the deficiencies and proper funding. And I've always been an advocate of, you know, funding support services for from elementary to high school, in other words, through the pre-K to 12 curriculum and educational systems in the nation, in our cities and towns and villages. You know, we're cutting out because, you know, once there's a funding issue, the first services that get cut in most cases, unfortunately, is support services. Mm. So when many of our young children, you know, that have mental illness or other traumatic issues or bullying or other situations that are not addressed properly, you know, these young men and women, young boys and girls, grow up with these, you know, problems. And sometimes it can result in criminal activity and mental illness and other harms to society. And I think a lot of that could be prevented if there was an adequate amount of social workers and psychologists and counselors and that advise and took care of these matters early on. And that's part of the deficiencies, sometimes widespread, that we have in our urban educational systems and in society in general. You know, when you look at the homeless population and you look at what's going on, where New York City recently makes a commitment, well, we're gonna take care of our homeless problem. And then you find out they're giving them subsidies and grants so that they can go to Yonkers and Jersey City and Mount Vernon. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like a transformation of a homeless population from one city, one community to another. You know, you haven't addressed that problem. You moved them from one area to the other, and you took care of their problem. Now they're homeless in Yonkers, and Yonkers has to deal with it, and Westchester County has to deal with it. So this is issues, Hezzy, that are of serious concern.
Before you go, just one last thing is, how do people then reach out to your office? Is there like a phone number that they can call? Or
you know,
do they send an email
again,
so that you can get an understanding of what positions they hold and that they want to share with you?
As I said, the office is located at 35 East Grassy Sprain Road, right off Tuckahoe.
Right.
It's centrally located. There's bus transportation that goes there.
Right.
You know, the office is 406. It's been there for many years. I think the last 5-6 assembly persons had the same office.
Yeah.
So if you visited Assemblywoman Shelley Mayer in the past, or formerly Assemblyman Mike Spano, or Lou Masiello, or Cecile Singer, it's the same office.
Mm-hmm.
And the office number there is 914-779-8805. You know, again, it's an office that is designed to be constituent oriented. You know, my role is to really promote among my staff you know, this attitude of the citizen comes first, the constituent. Even though people may not like our final decisions on legislation, you know, we always want individuals to feel that, look, your voice will be heard, you will be respected, give us your opinion. And honestly, very often, as I've said many times, sometimes I may have personal opinions on issues, but I sometimes, you know, would put them aside because I'm elected by the majority of constituents I represent. And my role would be to gather and see what their opinion is, the majority. And, you know, so it's a balance act with what's legitimate, what's legal, you know, what's the opinion of the majority. And sometimes if people don't speak up, it's hard for us as legislators to gauge. Like recreational marijuana, for example, when I talk to 100 people, and really at this point, 50 would say, well, I don't think it's a good idea for this reason and that reason. 50 of them would say, yeah, you know what? We can get tax revenue. It's going on all over. We can use it to fund the gaps in education and healthcare and so forth. Why not? Why should we lose out? You know, prohibition years ago, you couldn't buy alcohol, and now we got it monitored. You have DWI laws, and, you know, that's fine. You know, you take the criminal activity out of it, and now the criminal justice system doesn't deal with alcohol the same way it did years ago. Now it's basically if you violate DWI laws and so forth, or Drum Act legislation, that's the case. But that's why with these two main issues, you know, we need to hear from the public at large, you know, just to see what is in the best interest. Right now, you know, as a legislator, under the circumstances, I'm probably leaning to support, you know, sport gambling and betting, and feel that, you know, as long as we monitor and provide adequate services to prevent, you know, gambling addictions and issues like that, that, yeah, I can see, you know, Yonkers and state of New York, you know, gaining some additional revenue that can address our shortfalls. Recreational marijuana, I'm still seriously on the bench on that. I'm still looking. I can go either way. But again, it's gonna be determined by, you know, the information we receive, the final maybe month or two of lobbying to see which way we need to look at. You know, so that's a fair assumption.
I don't disagree with your positions because, you know, you have credible rationale for it. The only thing that I'm concerned about is we once had an agreement with respect to how much money the casino was paying the city of Yonkers, which also harbored other responsibilities like security and stuff like that, a burden on the infrastructure as well. All these things come into play, but somehow or another, we're getting less and less, despite the fact that it was written in that we were going to get more. So how do you substantiate, not you personally, but how does the legislation substantiate that, hey, this is the agreement, this is the agreement. And there's got to be a way to put an end to that. Who's responsible for giving us our fair share?
Well, see, the old agreement, you know, was such where with Empire Casino, Yonkers would get that $19.6 million. But then, you know, what was wrong with that agreement, it placed a number and it just kept the same number moving forward. You know, I would have set up a system where, yes, you agree with 19.6 as a starting point, but based on revenue enhancement or revenue increases, there should also be a percent increase equivalent with what you give in that fund into Yonkers. So, you know, looking at rough figures, during the last 10, 15 years that we've been getting the 19.6, you know, you realize that the casino and the facility was generating, you know, 200+% increases in their revenue. So that should have been reflected in increases from the 19.6. Our discussions with MGM, you know, really dealt with a need for them, you know, moving forward if they're looking to grow and advance with our support and commitment, mm-hmm. you know, part of that has to be, in my opinion, an increase of an additional $10 million as a startup point, where that mm-hmm. extra $10 million, you know, would help address some of the structural problems in our budget with education in Yonkers. And again, yeah. some commitment that if MGM continues to grow and advance as it plans to do, not only for Yonkers, but for the entire region, then there should be further increases that are, you know, understood and committed to early on. That's the problem with when you put forth legislative initiatives and you put forth that you need sometimes, you know, the experience, you need the legal mind, you need to say, well, how do we address this so that moving forward, you know, we're clear, there's a meeting of the minds, as they say, where there's a clear mm-hmm. understanding with who's responsible and to what extent and when change needs to take place and how, you know, clear. The more clear agreements are, honestly, in the future, there's less disagreement, there's less fighting. You know, it's clear that, you know, you make X amount, you give X amount. You lose X amount, you know, this is in proportion to whatever, you know, arrangements or percentages are put forth. And that's what I feel with MGM, with, you know, other businesses, with all the development going on in the city of Yonkers. And I see investors and developers fighting to get into our city. I think there should be less give outs. I think there should be, you know, we should start focusing on increasing our tax base and making sure that, mm-hmm. You know, we have enough funding to make sure that, you know, our vital services are protected. You know, do we have adequate fire facilities for all these new major developments going on the whole mm-hmm. waterfront? Is our engine yep. trucks capable of reaching, God forbid, a fire that takes place in those areas? Did they check the infrastructure? Yep. Did they check the facilities material that they would use yeah. it? You know, these are part yep. of the planning, I think, that takes place. You know, you have issues involving now with this extensive influx of businesses in Yonkers. You know, biggest complaint is, you know, how slow sometimes the planning and zoning and development and housing department moves or doesn't move. You know, that's another issue. We're reaching out to the city to try to make sure yeah. that, you know, businesses that are moving in the city are not handcuffed to many extent. I'm hearing from local mm-hmm. businesses that, oh, the normal time is at least 6 months, you know, to get proper paperwork right. processed. I mean, for someone looking to start a business, that's a lot of time, you know, to yeah. waste, where you have to pay rent and, you know, and sometimes unnecessary delay. These are crucial points, and these are things that, you know, are not in the forefront of news, but they should be, or at least they should be yes. on the forefront of discussions going on when we talk about how do we make things more efficient for residents and businesses and promote more business development and make business expansion in Yonkers more friendly rather than controversial and adversarial. So these are the types of things that in my role, people say, well, you're a state legislator, but I'm a Yonkers guy. You know, I've lived in this town over yeah. 60 years. I'm a homeowner here. You know, all my life mm-hmm. I grew up here in Yonkers. So for me, yes, you know, I get involved with these issues because you know, when you walk day to day and you hear, you know, you see a lot of that, you know, so right. you have firsthand experience of these concerns, and some of them honestly trouble you. They really bother, because at the end of the day, you want fairness, you want equitability, whether it's in education or business development. You want the system to work best. And, you know, listening to you, Hezzy, right. that's been your theme all along. You know, you want things to be proper. You want transparency. You want equity in whatever mm-hmm. takes place. And I agree with that. I think, you know, That's our role, no matter what hat we wear.
That's why people voted for you. I wonder if people realized when they voted for you initially that they would get all of that. That what a phenomenal package that you represent. You know, again, education and law and humanity. It's just amazing. And then, like you said, you're a Yonkers guy, so that everything helps. And then a worldly view, which that helps as well. We're very lucky to have you. At least I think.
Well,
so.
Well, I'm happy and I enjoy the role, Hezzy. And I look forward to many more discussions. And, you know, it's always great to at least have open discussions. You know, and when we speak, you and I, it's really to try to send a message to the listening audience of how, you know, the more knowledge, the more awareness they become aware, the more their voices can be heard louder. And that they should vote, they should participate. We did a whole battery of new voter registration reforms so that really nobody has an excuse not to vote. You have early voting, you know, where 10 days before the election you can vote. I have a bill that allows students, you know, to register, you know, 16 and 17 year olds can now register to vote and allow them at city campuses, at SUNY and CUNY campuses.
Really?
To make sure there's voting sites at the colleges. So really, nobody has a reason to say, oh, I couldn't vote, I got delayed at work, or whatever the reason may be. Now voting is a process. Now the biggest issue we have is that, you know, primaries in many districts, in many parts of our state, the primary becomes a real election. And the mindset of regular voters is that, well, primaries, it's not important. So 5-10% of mainstream voters vote in a primary, which is terrible. And then, you know, if you have a special interest group that pushes hard or single issue groups, they can come out 40%. So at the end of the day, you can elect individuals in a primary that, in my opinion, is a real election. You know, that don't reflect or represent the majority. So we need to change the mindset. Even if you change the name of primary to early elections and late elections or spring elections and fall elections, so that the turnout is at least 50%. You can begin to say, you know what, whoever we elect is elected by the majority at the very least. But right now, in many communities, the primary, based on 5-10% of the turnout, is electing the candidates that will serve the people. And that's something that's crucial, you know, that I hope we can have some impact moving forward. It's not easy, but it needs to happen.
No, but at least you're contending with the issue and the concern. I think that's 99% of the issue. That's really good.
Yeah.
Well, at least you're focused on it, so that means that at least more people will pay attention to it as well. Great point. Well, I don't want to keep you forever. Just have a safe drive up to Albany tomorrow.
I will.
We're supposed to get a little bit of snow today, so be careful driving.
Yeah, we enjoy the ride. We leave early in the morning.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and looking forward. It's a new session. I have one session under my belt. I have a couple of dozen of new good bills. I feel like I know the system a lot, even though a lot, I think, was accomplished in the first year. We're looking forward to better and bigger things, Hezzy. And,
That's
you know,
great.
I appreciate, you know, your outreach. And let's continue to hopefully get on the show and talk about maybe do our little progress reports as we move on.
Okay, that would be phenomenal. That really is. I think people want to know. It's just they don't have an opportunity usually to know what's going on. Legislation is so vital to understand the demeanor of where we're going as a state as well as a city.
Have a good day and happy New Year to you and to everyone listening.
That's right.
Take care, Hezzy. Bye-bye.
Happy New Year. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than Nader Sayers. He's the assembly member representing District 90, which is all Yonkers. And he just knows stuff. That's the beauty of it. Okay, let me just quickly look to see if anything else has transpired on the national or international stage that we need to even think about. And bear with me one moment. And one second. One moment here. Let me quickly look because I haven't been able to see if anything else has transpired anywhere while I was talking to Mr. Sayers and Assemblyman Sayers. So bear with me another moment here. Let's see if there's any reaction actually from Asia to what's going on. Bear with me a moment here. Never can tell. Well, this is interesting because I don't know if you've been following it. Well, this is really interesting. Actually, we want to talk about Asia. We talk about Australia as well. The military has been deployed across Australia for the bushfire relief as another heat wave looms over the country. Unbelievable. Reserve troops were deployed to fire-ravaged regions across three Australian states on Monday. That was yesterday. After a tarred weekend that turned swaths of land into smoldering, blackened hellscapes. Well, the bushfires have now destroyed an area the size of Ireland, according to official figures, and authorities warned the months-long crisis is not over as another heat wave looms. Well, firefighters joined by fresh teams from the United States and Canada were taking advantage of rainy and cooler conditions to tackle out-of-control blazes ahead of soaring temperatures forecast later this week. Military teams in the biggest ever call-up of reserves fanned out across eastern Australia to help emergency services assess the damage, restore power, and deliver supplies of food, water, and fuel to cut off communities. So for the first time in Australian history, the government also deployed its medical assistance team, normally sent to other countries to lend support in the aftermath of their disasters to help evacuees. There's no room for complacency, especially as we have over 130 fires burning across New South Wales, the state, and New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian had said that on Monday. That took the total amount of land burnt close to 8 million hectares, the size of the island of Ireland or South Carolina. Well, 24 people have lost their lives so far, with over 1,500 homes damaged. Two people are missing in New South Wales, the vast nation's most populous state, and the chair of the newly established Victoria State's Bushfire Appeal Fund, Pat McNamara, said, "This year's summer bushfire season was a creeping disaster. We're still not even into what we would regard as the peak of the fire season," McNamara told National Broadcaster Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. "So we've probably got at least another 4 or 5 weeks of this sort of weather, and we've got to deal with it in the usually picturesque southeastern town of Eden." Holly Spence said she had spent more than 12 hours defending her family's farm on Saturday, less than a week after saving it on New Year's Eve. "If we weren't here, the spot fires would have taken all our sheds and the house and everything," the 28-year-old advised. "We don't want to go through this for a third time." Fiona Kennelly, she's 50, who evacuated with 24 members of her extended family to a motel outside Eden, said she was relieved the easing conditions allowed them to get some respite from the crisis. "Good to see daylight at the right time again," she told Agent Thron's press, adding that the skies had been turning pitch black in the afternoons. Authorities were also grappling with the health conditions of heavy smoke engulfing cities and towns in or near fire-hit regions, including the country's second-largest city, Melbourne, and the national capital of Canberra. In Canberra, some government departments were shut as the city's air quality was once again ranked the poorest in the world, according to independent online air quality index monitor Air Visual. There has been growing anger in Australia about Prime Minister Scott Morrison's conservative government's slow response to the deadly climate-fueled bushfire crisis, with rallies calling for action planned across major cities this coming Friday. So very, very frightening sort of circumstances. We shouldn't forget what's going on in India. So evidently masked mob people or attackers protesting students and teachers in India's top university. Seems that masked assailants beat students and teachers with sticks on the campus of a prestigious university in India's capital, injuring more than 20 people in an attack opposition lawmakers are trying to link to the government. Well, videos that emerged after late Sunday's assault showed people in masks roaming the corridors of Jawaharlal Nehru University, JNU, in the Indian capital of New Delhi, and beating students who were protesting against a fee hike. Most of the injured were treated at a hospital for cuts and bruises, said R.T. Vij, a spokeswoman of the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. Sahiba Mazid, who spoke to Reuters by telephone from inside one of the university hostels, said that many men wearing masks and carrying batons had entered the hostel. New Delhi Police Commissioner Amulya Patnaik said that the incident was a clash between rival student groups. JNU students on social media, however, blamed members of the Akhil Bharatiya Vidyarthi Parishad, ABVP, the youth wing of the Hindu National Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, RSS, the ideological parent of India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. It denied they had instigated clashes and said they were first attacked by the left-leaning students. Opposition politicians also blamed the ABVP for the attack. The fascists in control of our nation are afraid of the voices of our brave students. Today's violence in JNU is a reflection of that fear, tweeted Rahul Gandhi, a leading politician of the main opposition Congress party. So Akhil Bharatiya Vidyarthi Parishad, which includes students at JNU, released a statement saying they didn't start Sunday's violence and insisted their members were attacked first by students with links to the Communist Party Communist Party groups. And JNU, one of India's most prestigious universities, has a history of left-wing activism. Many there have also in recent years protested against Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the BJP, accusing them of curbing free speech. Government was quick to condemn the violence. Horrifying images from JNU, the place I know and remember, was one of fierce debates and opinions, but never violence. I unequivocally condemned the events of today, Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman, a member of the Prime Minister's party, said on Twitter. BJP distanced itself from the ABVP and the JNU violence. This is a desperate attempt by forces of anarchy who are determined to use students as cannon fodder to create unrest to shore up their shrinking political footprint. Universities should remain places of learning and education, the BJP said on Twitter. And hours after the attack, students across the country took to the streets to protest the incident. Hundreds of students and ordinary people of the city gathered outside police headquarters in New Delhi and accused police officers of inaction. So in Mumbai, students from several educational institutions gathered at the gateway of India and demanded that the government act against assailants. So students at the university in Uttar Pradesh state held a candlelight march to protest the incident. The violence comes and amid simmering anger over the government's new citizenship law, which has resulted in a series of violent protests and clashes across the country that have left at least 24 people dead. So it just continues. It seems the world is in total upheaval no matter where you look. Unbelievable. And the world is convulsing as well. Flooding, fires, and more flooding, earthquakes, and all kinds of stuff is happening all over the world. And then political upheaval. Just truly amazing what's happening around the world. And so it's hard to be able to tell, what's going to happen. And then we have the potential of looming turmoil in the Middle East. So I don't know where you go with all of this stuff. It's just really hard to tell, and can't even fathom where it's all going to go. All right. Well, it looks like we're basically at the end of our time with you. I want to thank you for being with us today. And I wish you all well. Thank you very, very much. And have a great day. Let's see, tomorrow is Wednesday. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, actually, what we're doing tomorrow. Yeah, I don't have anything planned for tomorrow. I'm going to need that time off, so we won't be speaking with you tomorrow. And but we'll see you again on Thursday. John and Lori Wiles and Gabriella Metzl. That'll be our program day for Thursday. And then also we'll be speaking to Mayor Victoria Garrity. And I don't remember the second person on Friday as well. So there's a lot to do, that is for sure. So we'll catch up with you on Thursday. All the best and have a great day. Bye.